Matthew chapter 4, verses 5 through 7. The 10th talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew was presented by Ron Julian on May 17, 2015 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
Okay, we are continuing on in the book of Matthew, chapter 4. Today we're going to look at the second temptation of the three temptations of Jesus in the wilderness. Let's remind ourselves what's happening in these temptations. From my perspective, Jesus has just been baptized by John the Baptist. He has seen the heavens open. He has seen the Spirit of God descend upon him in some visible dove-like way. He has heard a voice declare, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." And yet, after these dazzling supernatural demonstrations that he is indeed the Messiah, the Son of God, Jesus is not led off in triumph. He instead is led by the Spirit of God to wander hungry for 40 days in the wilderness. It is this tension that is at the heart of the temptations. On the one hand, Jesus has powerful assurances from God that he, Jesus, is God's beloved Son, is the Messiah, and yet, on the other hand, God has led Jesus into great hardship and deprivation. He has been assured by God that he has a glorious destiny, because the Son of God has a glorious destiny. One day he will rule over all the world in peace and righteousness, and yet, right now, God is asking him to suffer. Jesus knows, and I think this is important to understand the temptations, Jesus knows that God wants him to be in the wilderness going hungry. At the end of the 40 days, Satan comes to tempt him. Satan wants to destroy Jesus personally, but even more importantly, Satan's purpose is to disqualify Jesus as the Messiah. He wants to destroy God's plan of salvation. It doesn't say that specifically in the text, but I think it's pretty clear that's the goal. And yet, God has a deeper, overriding purpose for this encounter between Jesus and Satan. God is testing Jesus. God wants to show that Jesus is, in fact, qualified to be the Messiah. Furthermore, God deliberately sets up the circumstances to echo the story of Israel's wandering in the wilderness. Like Israel, Jesus is led by God into the wilderness. Like Israel, Jesus is left to go hungry in the wilderness. Like Israel, Jesus is led by God for a time period of 40. 40 years for Israel, 40 days for Jesus. Like Israel, Jesus is being tested in the wilderness. Like Israel, Jesus had received miraculous assurances from God. Israel was promised that God would lead them to the promised land, and they had witnessed the parting of the Red Sea and a number of other miracles. Jesus was assured that he indeed was the Messiah and had witnessed the opening of the heavens, the descent of the dove, the voice of God. So, like Israel, Jesus must confront the tension between the great promises from God and the great hardships he is currently facing. Jesus himself shows that he understands this parallel between Israel and himself. He does this by quoting from a particular sermon of Moses. After Israel had wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, Moses preached a sermon to them. It's what we find in the book of Deuteronomy. They were about to enter into the promised land, and Moses reminded them of the lessons that they should have learned in the wilderness. And it is this sermon, and only this sermon, that Jesus quotes from in his three responses to Satan. Jesus understands that Israel faced the same issues that he himself is facing in the wilderness. And why has God deliberately set up Jesus' testing to remind us so strongly of Israel's testing in the wilderness? Well, I think it is to remind us that Jesus is succeeding where Israel failed. It is sort of a symbolic enactment for us. Israel was called to be a blessing to the world and to themselves by being faithful to God, but they failed to bless either the world or themselves. But now Jesus, who in a kind of symbolic sense is the true Israel, is passing the test that they failed. He is the one who will fulfill the hopes of Israel. He is the one who will bring blessing to Israel and to all the world. And then finally, I think God takes him through these things to show us, in reading these stories, how we should respond to the testing of our own faith. Okay, so that's what I think is going on in general. So we're going to turn now to the second temptation specifically. We're in Matthew 4, verses 5 through 7. Then the devil took him into the holy city and had him stand on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, 'He will command his angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up, so that you will not strike your foot against a stone.'" Jesus said to him, "On the other hand, it is written, 'You shall not put the Lord your God to the test.'" So before we get to the heart of what's happening here, there are a few details that I should probably say something about. It says that the devil took him into the holy city. That, of course, is Jerusalem. We're not told how Satan took him there. I'm not even going to speculate on exactly how this happened. It says that the devil has him stand on the pinnacle of the temple. So let me tell you what this does not mean, as I would understand it. We are not to picture that we're standing in front of a big temple building, and it has like a peak or a steeple or something like that on it, and Jesus is standing up on this peak, and the crowd is looking at the temple and looking up and say, "There's some guy standing up there. It looks like he's going to jump. He must be crazy." This is not the scenario as I would understand it. Instead, we're likely talking about one of the corners of the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount is a big raised platform. A lot of you know what it's like. And there are several corners that jut out high above the land below. There's no necessary reason why anyone at all would have seen this event. One corner of the Temple Mount, which is the one that I'm inclined to think is being talked about here, was not on the city side of the temple. It looked down on the ravine outside the city. It would have been at that time a very long fall from that corner, and there's no reason why there would necessarily be all that many people around. Satan urges Jesus to jump, and he supports his point by quoting Psalm 91. So basically, I would say the psalm is about how God will protect those who put their trust in him. The psalmist writes, "I will say to Yahweh, my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust." And then the psalmist gives various figurative pictures of how God protects the one who puts his trust in God. Like he says, "It is Yahweh who delivers you from the snare of the trapper. You will not be afraid of the terror by night or of the arrow that flies by day. You will tread upon the lion and the cobra." All of these are pictures of how protected the person who has put his trust in Yahweh will be. And as a part of that list, the psalmist says, "For he will give his angels charge concerning you to guard you in all your ways. They will bear you up in their hands that you do not strike your foot against a stone." So, from my perspective, we're just looking at a metaphorical sort of description of the kinds of protection that God gives the person who entrusts himself to God. This is how God is your fortress, if you will look to him for that protection. So, it's a little bit hard to say just how sophisticated Satan's argument is here. There's something I'm really interested in, exegetical questions, you know, how do you understand what a passage is particularly saying? There's something a little unattractive and unseemly about trying to figure out what Satan's exegetical method was. I found myself sort of, that is kind of a distasteful sort of thing to think about. But, okay, so what is he doing though here? Perhaps he's just wildly pulling this verse out of context. Some people would say that. He says, look, it says his angels will bear you up and you won't strike your foot against a stone, so jump. And the angels will bear you up and you won't strike your foot against a stone. If that's what he's doing, it's fairly obvious that he's not using the text very well when he does that. As I say, I think it is more a metaphorical picture of how God takes care of those who rely upon him. So his angels will bear you up is one of those pictures. I think, though, that Satan may be using more sophistication than that. He could be saying something like this. Look, Jesus, this psalm shows how God protects those who put their trust in him. Now, if you're the Son of God, then you, of all people, can be confident that God is going to protect you. And what could be a greater act of trusting and relying on God than jumping into the ravine below? And isn't it fitting that this psalm that speaks of God's protection for those who trust him uses this metaphorical language about the angels bearing you up? Because that is, in fact, literally what would happen here, isn't it? God would send his angels to catch you because you are the Son of God and because you have shown so much trust in him by jumping. So go ahead, Jesus. Jump. Now, if that is what Satan is doing, I called it more sophisticated, but it's trickier. In the end, his point is not a good one, as we'll see. Now, for you and me, the invitation to jump to our death would not be particularly tempting. I can think of many things that someone might tempt me to do that I would be more likely to do than to look down into a deep ravine and jump. I probably would find it easy to say, no thanks, I'm a righteous person who resists temptation. But in this case, it is the very outrageousness of the act that forms part of its attraction. It would be an act of great faith, and God would respond with an act of great deliverance. Okay, so now the question is, how does Jesus respond? How does he see the issue here? He's not going to do it, but why isn't he going to do it, and what is it that he sees the temptation as being? Well, let me remind you of my approach to these temptations. Jesus responds to each temptation by quoting from Moses' sermon in Deuteronomy. And in doing so, I think that Jesus shows us what he understands to be the real issue in the temptation. He answers Satan by repeating the point that Moses had made. So for me, the best way to understand what the dynamic is in the temptation is to understand what Moses was saying in his sermon, because that is the point that I think Jesus is using to deflect the temptation. It is the truth in what Moses said that he is using to say, no, I'm not going to go in that direction. And Moses, in turn, then, is referring back to an event during Israel's wandering in the wilderness. So we can't really understand Jesus' response to the temptation or even what the nature of the temptation is unless we understand what Moses said in his sermon, which in turn goes back to what happened to Israel in the wilderness. So just like last week, what I would like us to do is work from back to front. We'll start by looking at what happened in the wilderness, then we will see what Moses said about it, and then finally we will return to Matthew so that we can see how Jesus applies Moses' words to his own situation. I suppose it's theoretically possible that I may someday teach something out of Matthew where I do not go back and look at something in the Old Testament, but it hasn't happened yet. Okay, Jesus is quoting from Deuteronomy 6:16, where Moses says, "You shall not put Yahweh your God to the test as you tested him at Massah." So that gives us our marching orders. What we need to do is to go back and look at the time Israel tested God at Massah. That's where we need to start. That incident is found in Exodus 17, starting in verse 1. Just before we read it, let's just remind ourselves of what Israel has gone through just before the events of Exodus 17. When they were in Egypt, God had come to them through Moses and promised to free them from slavery in Egypt and take them to the promised land, the land that he had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And at first, they don't believe it. They don't listen to Moses. But then God sends 10 plagues upon the Egyptians. These plagues strike the Egyptians, but not the Israelites. This includes the Passover, one of the great events in the history of Israel, when the angel of death passed over them and none of them died. As a result of the plagues, the Egyptians let Israel go, but then the Egyptian army chases Israel to the shore of the Red Sea. God causes the Red Sea to part so Israel can escape the Egyptian army by crossing to the other side on dry land. And then God closes the waters over the Egyptian army to destroy them when they try to follow. Soon after that, when Israel encounters water that is bitter and undrinkable, God changes it to fresh, drinkable water. When Israel has no food in the wilderness, God sends the manna from heaven every morning. All these things have happened just before the story we read in Exodus 17. Exodus 17:1. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin, according to the command of Yahweh, and camped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test Yahweh?" But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, "Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried out to Yahweh, saying, "What shall I do to this people? A little more, and they will stone me." Then Yahweh said to Moses, "Pass before the people, and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it that the people may drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. He named the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel and because they tested Yahweh, saying, "Is Yahweh among us or not?" And by the way, the word Massah means testing and the word Meribah means quarreling. Okay, so as we saw, Israel has had great promises from God, and they have seen God back up those promises with great miracles, but now there's a water problem again. They quarrel with Moses. Moses is afraid that they're going to kill him, and so God has Moses perform a miracle. Moses strikes the rock, and water gushes out. So once again, God shows himself to be both able and willing to take care of them. Now, the concept we're most concerned with here is the word test, because that's the one that Moses refers back to from Deuteronomy. Moses says to the people, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test Yahweh?" When I first read that, when I first did read it, it was not immediately clear to me what he means by the phrase to test Yahweh. In what sense were they testing God? Fortunately, though, we have an explanation after the story in verse 7 that I think makes it pretty clear. It says, "He, Moses, named the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel and because they tested Yahweh, saying, is Yahweh among us or not? So, as I said, the word Massa means testing. Moses named the place testing and also quarreling because this is a place, from his perspective, that they tested Yahweh. And then, fortunately, we're told what that means. They tested Yahweh, saying, is Yahweh with us or not? So, whatever testing Yahweh involves, it involves asking the question, is Yahweh with us or not? We talked about the concept of testing last week. People are put to the test so that it can be seen what kind of people they are. So I'm not certain what kind of person you are, so I put you to the test, and then the results of the test come in. I watch how you behave or respond in the test, and now I know what kind of person you are. That's the idea behind this word testing. We were talking about it last time in the context of the idea of testing or temptation, that the fact is that the Bible often describes God as testing people. That is, God often puts people in situations that bring out in the open what sort of people are they. Are they people of faith or not? So God, in fact, is described as testing Israel as he took them through the wilderness. In part, what was happening is their attitude toward God was coming out in the midst of the difficulties that they went through. But what we're told here is that in another sense, or maybe in the same sense, at the same time, Israel was testing God. They're asking the question, is God with us or not? And why are they asking that question? Because they feel like they don't know. We don't know whether he is with us. Look around. There's no water. How could he be with us and led us to a place where there's no water? So we would be foolish to trust too much in Moses and the God that he is appealing to here because, look, this God has not demonstrated himself to be trustworthy because there's no water. So they're putting him to the test by demanding that he demonstrate, that he prove himself trustworthy, because right now he doesn't look trustworthy. The Israelites do not consider that the 10 plagues, the parting of the Red Sea, the manna, and other miracles have adequately shown that God is with them. When a problem comes up, God has to prove himself all over again. He is still being tested by them. They're waiting to see the results of the test. How does God do? If he does pass the test, then they will consider trusting him again. There's one other place in the Exodus story where Israel is described as testing God, and this is very revealing as well. This is when they have finally arrived at the border of the Promised Land, the first time. Their reaction at this time is the final straw, and God reacts to them in wrath. This is in Numbers 14:22. God says, surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs, which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice, shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who spurned me see it. So here we are, they're at the verge of going into the land, but God declares they're not going in because they have put me to the test these 10 times. So we only have one passage that actually uses the language, they tested God. That's the one we just looked at in Exodus 17. But at the end of their time in the wilderness, their first time, as they're going toward the Promised Land, God pronounces, you have put me to the test 10 times. So all of the various responses that we see throughout Exodus and Numbers can fairly be described as putting God to the test. It's always the same sort of thing. So let me remind you of some of those incidents. We can see what we're talking about here. In the first, well, an early one is in Exodus 14:10. That's the story about how the Egyptian army chased Israel to the shores of the Red Sea. It says, as Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they became very frightened. So the sons of Israel cried out to Yahweh. Then they said to Moses, "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, 'Leave us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." So Israel has no trust in Moses or his God at this point. And I would say that this is one of the places where they tested God. In essence, they are asking the question, is God with us or not? And they're not inclined to think that he is. The 10 plagues were not enough to prove God's trustworthiness to them, not even when it included the Passover, which was this incredibly significant event. Just as at Massah, a little later, they quarrel with Moses and they test God. They will not give God their trust. They are calling into question whether he is with them. And then we could say that God passes the test. He parts the Red Sea and they are saved. And when it's all over, they kind of say, yeah, okay, well, that was pretty good. And it says that they believed in Moses and Yahweh. The next event is the first time Israel has trouble finding water in Exodus 15:22. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur. And they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore it was named Marah. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" So they have no confidence at this point that God will provide. They don't, for example, turn to Moses and say, "We should turn to God and ask for his help because he's been helping us along the way, and I'm sure that he will help us out here." And instead, basically, again, they quarrel with Moses and put God to the test. And God responds graciously once again. Then Moses cried out to Yahweh, and Yahweh showed him a tree, and he threw it into the waters, and the waters became sweet. So God does not punish them for calling his goodness into question at this point. Once again, he in fact provides for them, and we could say, in essence, he passes the test. The next setback is when they can't find food in the wilderness. We see this in Exodus 16, maybe starting with verse 2. The whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The sons of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by Yahweh's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." You notice that there's a certain consistency to the themes that are showing up in the way they respond to this. It's always, "Why did we listen to you? Why are we out here?" Okay, so once again, I would say this is following that same pattern. They quarrel with Moses and they test Yahweh. Once again, they are questioning whether God is with them or not, and inclined to think not. And once again, God provides, this time with the manna from heaven. And so we could say, once again, God passes the test. The next event is the one that we're looking at today in Exodus 17, at the place called Massah and Meribah. Here they are explicitly described as quarreling with Moses and putting God to the test, but that's what they've been doing all along. There are a number of other similar occasions. Let's just turn to the last one, when God brings them to the Promised Land.
This is in Numbers 13:32.
So you know the story probably. The Israelites get to the Promised Land, or to the border of the Promised Land. They send 12 spies into the land. 10 of those spies come back scared to death by what they saw and tell the people, "No way." So
starting in Numbers 13:32,
they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim." The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim. "They came like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. All the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. Why is Yahweh bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" So they said to one another, "Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt." Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation of the sons of Israel. Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land. So Joshua and Caleb are the two spies who did not give the bad report. So they tore their clothes, and they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, "The land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If Yahweh is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against Yahweh, and do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and Yahweh is with us. Do not fear them." But all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Okay, and as we saw, God responds with wrath. They refuse to trust him. He describes them as having put him to the test 10 times, and this is the final one. They have put him to the test. They hear the report of the spies. They refuse to believe that God can take care of them when they go into the land, and they want to kill anybody who would try to argue that they should go into the land, and they want to appoint a new leader and go back to Egypt. Every time something scary happens, they take it as evidence that God can't be trusted. They refuse to trust him until he meets their standards for what a trustworthy God would look like. Joshua and Caleb are the two spies who are different. They saw the same people, they went through the same land as the other 10, but they have a different perspective. God is on our side. We will prevail. But for the rest, they don't trust God, and God describes it as putting him to the test. This is what they have continually done. So it is this attitude that Moses is referring to in his sermon in Deuteronomy. Remember, Deuteronomy is written the second time Israel is at the border of the Promised Land. They have just spent 40 years wandering in the wilderness because of their faithlessness. Now a new generation is ready to go into the land, and Moses is reminding them of Israel's failures in the wilderness and warning them against them. So in Deuteronomy 6:16, Moses says, "You shall not put Yahweh your God to the test as you tested him at Massah." And now I think we understand what Moses means. At Massah, Israel realized that they had no water, and so they quarreled with Moses and put God to the test. In spite of the many ways God had shown his powerful care for them, they freaked out and refused to trust Yahweh. They were proclaiming, in essence, that they would only trust God if he did things exactly the way they wanted him to. Whether he was trustworthy now was an open question. We have to test him. He has to prove to us that he's trustworthy, because the fact that we're in this bad situation shows his trustworthiness is very much an open question. "We're only going to trust you, Yahweh, if you pass our test." And of course, Moses is only citing that one example, I think because this is the place where he actually named the place testing because of the way they tested God. But basically, they tested God every time any problem came up. The question of God's goodness and trustworthiness was an open question as soon as there wasn't any water, or as soon as there wasn't any food, or as soon as there were big people in the land that they were going into, or whatever. Moses is telling them that they can't keep doing that. As they go into the promised land, they're going to face the same issue. Will they trust God, or will they put him to the test? The entire sermon in Deuteronomy is a warning about how they need to actually trust God as they go into the promised land in a way that they didn't when they were going through the wilderness. If they keep testing God, then they're not going to end up staying in the promised land. He will punish them and they will be exiled, which is, in fact, what happened. They have to settle it in their minds that God is trustworthy and act on that trust. That's what it means not to test God. Okay, so now let's return to Matthew chapter 4, verse 5. Let me read it again. Then the devil took him into the holy city and had him stand on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, 'He will command his angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up so that you will not strike your foot against a stone.' Jesus said to him, 'On the other hand, it is written, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test.'" Let me repeat my paraphrase of what Satan might be saying here. Look, Jesus, this psalm shows how God protects those who put their trust in him. If you are the Son of God, then you of all people can be certain that God will protect you. And what could be a greater act of trusting and relying on God than jumping into the ravine below? And isn't it fitting that this psalm, which speaks of God's protection for those who trust him, uses this metaphorical language about the angels bearing you up? Because that is, in fact, literally what would happen here, isn't it? God would send his angels to catch you because you are the Son of God and because you have shown so much trust in him by jumping. Jesus responds by quoting from Moses' sermon, "You shall not put the Lord your God to the test." And now I think we have some idea of what that means and what Jesus must see at stake in this temptation. So, remember, the idea behind what Moses is saying is when God has led you into difficult situations, you should continue to trust him. You should not put God to the test. That is, you should not wait to put your trust in God until he passes your test, until he somehow demonstrates that he is trustworthy. He has already shown you that he is trustworthy. You should trust him now, even though right now he has led you to a difficult place. It seems to me then that this must be how Jesus sees Satan's temptation. Satan is tempting Jesus to put God to the test in just the way that Moses warned against. God has led Jesus into the wilderness, and he is starving. This is a very difficult situation and could call into question God's care for Jesus. Jesus is left waiting for God to come to his aid, and that can be a scary place to be. By jumping, Jesus would be attempting to force God's hand. God says he loves Jesus as his beloved son, but Jesus is out here starving in the wilderness. But if Jesus jumps, then God will have to act. God will have to demonstrate that he cares for Jesus, that Jesus is his beloved son. And so, Jesus would not be committing an act of faith at all. Instead, he would be faithlessly demanding that God prove himself. Jesus would be withholding his trust in God until God passes the test. In other words, Jesus would be putting God to the test just as Israel did. See, there's a very important point that Satan is conveniently not making here. In a sense, Jesus has already jumped off the pinnacle of the temple. That is, Jesus has done something that will lead to his death unless God intervenes. Jesus has followed the leading of God into the wilderness, and now he is starving. He has put his trust in God. He is waiting for God to provide, to say, "Okay, your fast is over." It is like he has jumped and is falling toward his doom. It's just a slower sort of fall. The difference is that Jesus did not presumptuously force God's hand. Jesus is not in the wilderness because he is trying to make God prove himself. He is in the wilderness because God led him there. The greatest act of faith is not jumping off the temple. The greatest act of faith is to stay where God has put him and to wait for God's deliverance. Jesus is waiting for God to deliver him, and so in a sense, he is believing what Psalm 91 said. In a sense, he is waiting for God's angels to bear him up so he does not strike his foot against a stone. So Jesus is already exercising the sort of faith that Satan was trying to tempt him to exercise, only he was doing it in trust instead of in presumption and questioning the goodness of God. Okay, it seems to me that all three of these temptations are rooted in the same thing. It's this tension that I was talking about, the tension between future promises and present hardship. Israel was promised that God would lead them into prosperity in a new land, and he had demonstrated his power and trustworthiness by parting the Red Sea and many other miracles. And yet, on the other hand, in the wilderness, Israel faced many difficulties, a lack of food, a lack of water, large enemies, and so on. The issue was, would they remember God's promises, God's goodness, God's power when they faced those present difficulties? Jesus, likewise, he saw the heavens opened and heard himself proclaimed as the beloved Son of God. In essence, he was promised a glorious future as God's chosen ruler over all the world. And God had made this promise in a very striking display of his acceptance of Jesus as the Messiah. And yet, God led Jesus into the wilderness and asked him to go without food. The issue was, would he remember God's goodness and God's power and God's promises when he faced the present difficulties? You and I are also facing that same tension. God has promised to rescue us from sin and death and the sufferings of this present age, and yet right now we face many hardships. Our own sin and the sins of everyone else make life bitter and hard. We all struggle in many ways, and we're all going to die. The issue for us is the same. Will we remember the promises, the goodness, and power of God as we struggle with the hardships of this life? In this second temptation, Satan is tempting Jesus to mistrust God because God has led Jesus into great hardship. Satan is subtly urging Jesus, make God prove that he is trustworthy. Don't trust him until he has passed the test. But Jesus knows that he already has every reason to trust the Father. God does not need to prove anything to Jesus. Jesus, in fact, is the one who is being tested. Will Jesus continue to wait faithfully for God to exalt him? Or will Jesus lose heart and mistrust God, insisting that he will not trust God until God proves himself? Well, we are in the same situation. We have great and magnificent promises from God. We have every reason to trust that God will keep those promises. And so for us to withhold our trust until God proves himself to us is an act of unbelief. Now, we might stop and ask ourselves whether everything that I just said is true. Do we, in fact, have every reason to trust God? We can understand why Israel would have every reason to trust God. They watched the power of God holding back the waters of the Red Sea while they walked through on dry land. And they saw many more miraculous displays of God's power. We can understand why Jesus would have every reason to trust God. For one thing, Jesus is a complicated topic, but in this story, we know at least one thing. He had just witnessed the heavens open, the Spirit descend upon him, and the voice of God declare him to be God's beloved Son. But we may feel that our situation is different. The waters haven't parted for us. The heavens haven't opened for us. Is the Bible really saying that God has nothing to prove to us? Yes, absolutely, I think so. The Bible would tell us that if we are mistrustful of God, it is our own rebellious hearts that make it so. God has revealed himself in creation. God has revealed himself in the scriptures. And God has made himself known in our own unique personal experience, if we are willing to see him there. You and I are in the wilderness right now, being tested, just as Israel was, just as Jesus was. God has done great things in the past. God has promised great things for our future, and it is left to us, therefore, to trust him in the present. The great temptation that we face is to withhold our trust. Just as Israel was, just as Jesus was, we are being tempted to test God. We are tempted to think that we are right to mistrust him. Surely no one could expect us to rely on a God who has yet to prove his trustworthiness. Jesus is our model for how we should react to those temptations. God has nothing to prove, no need to pass the test. Rather, Jesus knew that he himself was the one being tested. Would he continue to trust God or not? And our situation is the same. We are in no position to demand that God pass our tests. He has shown that he is trustworthy. Rather, our faith is the one that's being tested. Are we people who will put their faith in the promises of God or not? And of course, Jesus is more than just a model for us, as I've been saying. In these temptations, Jesus is showing himself worthy to be the Messiah of God. God has promised him the world. And yet, when God takes him through great sufferings, Jesus continues to trust God without fail. Because Jesus is truly a man of humble trust, he is worthy to be exalted by God. And lastly, I do believe that we see here Jesus as the one who succeeded where Israel failed. That first generation that was rescued from Egypt tested God 10 times. They ultimately were denied access to the promised land for their refusal to trust God. And in the end, that turned out to be true for the nation as a whole. They stayed in the land for a while, but ultimately they were sent out into exile because their leaders and their people would not stop putting God to the test. Jesus, their greatest son, has, I think, in a kind of a symbolic way, enacted in the wilderness the faithfulness which they never achieved. And in the end, his faithfulness will be their salvation. Okay, so if you have any comments or questions, now would be a good time for them. Just raise your hand.
A question that's not exactly addressed, but maybe you could speculate.
That's what I'm good at.
Is the temptation of Jesus for the sake of Jesus or for the sake of his followers, or did it just sort of happen that way?
That's a very good question, and I have an answer. I just have to pull my thoughts together to give it. I think all of those things are a part of what's happening. I think we know from some of the things like that it says in Hebrews, the language there, that Jesus learning obedience through the things that he suffered. It's very difficult for me to put myself in the place of the sinless man. But the way I picture what's happening there is that, okay, you and I, maybe we see that the right way to go is down this road. And the problem is we may make it a little way down that road, but then our own selfishness or fears or whatever interfere, and we don't make it very far. So then we got to sort of pick ourselves up and try again. Jesus, it seems to me, is the one who fought the hardest and understands the deepest what it means to truly be an obedient human being. Because at every place where he had to choose to suffer or go without or face difficulty or whatever in order to be trusting and obedient to his Father, he always went that way. He never did not go that way. So that means he took on the suffering, and then you find out that most of the time, if you do the right thing, that just means now you're even in a harder situation, and now you got more right stuff that you need to do. Jesus took it all the way down that road. So I'm picturing the kind of learning that we're talking about here as the actual experience of learning the depths of what it means to be obedient to God. So I picture throughout those 40 days in the wilderness that as the hunger is coming upon him and he's dealing with various things, that at every place he's thinking about the fact that God has him there and wants him to be there. And at every opportunity, he's turning away from the possibility of self-pity or resentment against God or anything like that. And so culminating in at his moment of weakness, the tempter comes and hits him with these things. And so he is learning through experience what human righteousness is all about and what it's supposed to look like. I don't know if I'm being clear, but that's the way I picture it. So yes, in that sense, at least that much, and probably in a number of other ways, it's for him. This is a very significant thing that's happening to him. But at the same time, it is also he, I think, recognizes that he is our forerunner. He is the one who is leading us into what it means to follow God. So why did he tell this story? If it had only been for him, why tell the story to his disciples to tell us? Because I think there's also the fact that we can see in what he did what it looks like to be faithful to God. And also God set up the scenario, from my perspective, to be a kind of a picture of Jesus fulfilling Israel's destiny, in a sense, that sort of thing. And that's something that is significant to us. And then that issue of Jesus being tested for his suitability to be the Messiah, you could say, I guess, that that would be partly for him, but it's also partly for us. I mean, so I think they're all kind of wrapped together. That's how I'd kind of see it right now.
Thanks, Ron. It seems like, from what I'm hearing, that the issue with tempting God isn't that God just doesn't like it, or he said not to, or he might be found wanting after you test him. It seems like the issue with tempting God, why it's such a bad way to go, is what it says about me. That if I'm the kind of person that says, yeah, I'd love to believe God, I'm ready to do it, he just has to do X, that's showing a lack of responsibility and integrity on my part. That's not just kind of a flippant lack of responsibility, but a real abdication of personal responsibility, where instead of the choice being on me to trust God, I would keep moving the goalposts, like, well, yeah, you know, God did X, but he really didn't do it, kind of. He should have known I needed more or something. Any thoughts on that?
I think so, yeah. Your comments remind me that I should, it would be good to clarify, the idea that we should not test God does not mean that I should believe in God and entrust my destiny to him for no reason. If I were to wonder, is there a reason why I should do this, that would be testing God. I don't think that's the picture that we get. Jesus himself responds, think in the Gospel of John, how he keeps talking about how there is this testimony as to why we ought to believe that he's the Messiah. And a big part of that testimony is God working miracles through him. This is God sort of putting his seal of approval on him and saying, okay, this is the Messiah. So in one sense, for me to look for rational reasons why I would entrust myself to God is appropriate. The issue becomes when, from God's perspective, I have every reason to trust him, but I've been given a helping that I don't want. I've got something on my plate that I don't want there, and now I have backed off. I've removed my trust from God until he can justify himself for why have I got that on my plate. Now, it's a very human thing. Notice that as they went through the wilderness, those 10 times, the first time they put him to the test, God didn't slap him down. He, okay, here's some fresh water. Okay, let's part the Red Sea, get the Egyptians out of the way. Okay, here's the manna, here's the quails. All right, right, yep, hit the rock, let's have the water gush out. They were faithless, but in a lot of ways, the human journey is a long and difficult one, and we arrive at faith through a lot of struggle. So the fact that we would at times not give God the trust that he has earned. I mean, all of us do that. None of us trust God as much as he deserves. But the issue becomes ultimately whether, am I wrestling? Am I struggling? Or have I written him off? And ultimately, I think what God's saying to Israel in those 10 times is, you're not struggling with this. You have written me off. And so I'm writing you off. So yeah, what is at stake is that inner willingness to fight back, that inner willingness to see the truth, even in the face of the difficulties that we encounter. In another sort of context, I could give an entire sermon on how challenging this life of faith is and how messy it is and how much we should be merciful to each other as we find ourselves in the midst of these struggles, because they're not easy. Jesus, like I say, Jesus faced it. He never backed down. Every implication, he faced it squarely into it and said, no, I will take that. No, I will take that. I will take that because I know the God that I have put my trust in. So with those parameters around what you said, then I think, yeah, I would agree with what you said.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Ron. I just brought to light the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus fell on his face and said, my Father, if it's possible, may this cup be taken from me. But then he says, yet not as I will, but as you will.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of shows that he didn't want to go forward. He didn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But yet he still trusted God.
Right.
So that's kind of a good way of looking it, because it makes us feel like, in a way, we can't ask God for something different.
Right.
We do ask for our circumstances to change.
Right.
But that's not the issue. The issue is, but your will and not my will. So it's,
yes,
that's where it's really dicey. It's like really hard to understand sometimes. How far do you take that?
Right.
Trust. You ask, and then you have to just back away and say, okay, but whatever you do, that's fine with me, kind
right.
of thing.
No, that's very good. I mean, that's the model. It is not faithless. Obviously, it's not faithless to ask God to change the difficult circumstances that I am in. Paul describes himself as going back 3 times concerning this thorn in the flesh, whatever it was that he had going on, until he finally, it's clear to him, the answer is, no, I'm not going to do that. And my strength is perfected in weakness, God says to him. So, yeah, it's that I would ask you to change my circumstances is not faithless,
right,
if the understanding is I recognize that ultimately the lesson from the first temptation is that life comes from God. It is his will, his provision ultimately that is going to be my deliverance. So I may think what I need is right now, I don't have any of this and I need it, or I have this bad stuff and I don't want it, but to acknowledge, but you are the source of life. So I don't know how to deal with this, but I'm going to keep hanging in there. That's right. It also reminds me of another thing that I realize I meant to say in here and I didn't say. It's kind of, this is a little bit tangential, but it's easy to read that the not putting God to the test as you look at the situation. What you're not supposed to do is ask God to do something miraculous, like, God, I'll believe in you if you make the building float in the air or something like that. Oh, that would be testing God. Well, that's not a good thing to do either, but that's not really the thing that's being talked about here. The testing is the thing that you do when you don't know whether I'm going to test you because I don't know the answer about you. And to test God is to say, I don't know what to think of you, God, so I'm going to wait to see. I'm going to withhold judgment until I see the results of how this comes out. And at a certain point, to withhold the judgment that God is trustworthy is a faithless thing to do, because even though I am in difficulty, he deserves my trust. So this is something we have to work out with God individually. We all have our struggles. We all face different sorts of things. It can get pretty messy in the I greatly want to have the attitude that I could come to God and say, let this cup pass from me, but not my will, but yours be done. But it, speaking personally, it's a lot messier than that. I'm very much tempted at times to think, why am I doing this? But that's part of why God takes us through this stuff. It's a kind of a refining fire. It forces us to confront our own attitudes about the stuff and have to decide what we're really going to do with them. So it isn't fun. God had asked me, I would have set it up differently. But you're all fortunate that he didn't ask me. Okay?
Regarding testing, you're probably going to get to this. If you keep going in math, yeah, obviously you said you're going to stop in a couple of weeks, so not in series, but when you get to the section on, I think it's Jesus and Beelzebul, but as, I was in one of Jack's classes, I think, a few years ago when he taught on this. And short answer is that at the end, Jesus, even though like most of the things Jesus teaches from, he's not direct about, he says that if someone is unbelieving, it's better not to believe, better not to confront someone with the truth if they're going to be unbelieving about it.
Right. Okay, so I think the teaching you're talking about is where they accuse Jesus of casting out the demons by Beelzebul, and he tells that parable or whatever it is. I don't even know what to think of it, but the thing about the casting the demons out and they go through waterless places and it brings back seven that's worse. And I remember what Jack said about that he saw that as that for someone who's hard-hearted to attack that with direct, like Jesus doing another miracle for them, would just make it worse for them because they would take that in and then they would have to work even harder to deny it and to deny that it forced them to trust in Jesus or something like that. And so the latter state, they would be even more confirmed in their hard-heartedness or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, I don't know. When I get to that, I'm going to have to rethink what I think is going on there. And I don't know at the moment what I think is going on there. So can you tell me, how were you thinking that was related to what we're talking about here?
Yeah, what I was getting at is what Israelites at the very beginning,
okay,
God wasn't exactly sure about when passing judgment on whether they were hard-hearted or simply from unbelief.
Okay, so then the fact that he didn't really pronounce judgment on them until
those times. By the tenth time,
right,
it was.
Right. Well, I'm sure God knew what was going on.
Yeah.
It's certainly true for us that we're in no position to judge either ourselves or others, I think, by the fact that we see failure to be faithful in our lives, because everyone is going to encounter that. Okay, I think we should probably stop at this point because we're a little over time.